Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Now, we're going to be talking with Howard Schultz, who's considering an independent candidacy for presidency in just a couple of minutes. He's traveling the heartland, doing things the candidates do. What's interesting to me, and I'm going to talk to him about this, is intense blowback against the idea that anyone would try to get, you know, in between this binary choice in the American voters. I'll ask him why he's not running as a Democrat, why he's not running as a Republican in a couple of minutes. But I'm in Austin, Texas, at a journalism conference right now, and it's one of these many, many events where journalists get together and scratch their heads and talk about how can we rebuild trust? You know, what is the nature of the problem? And my role is often to be the guy that raises his hand and says, first of all, acknowledge that many of the criticisms of the news media are in fact valid. And that if you think back over the last 20 years, and I've been part of all of this, I would think of all of the major industries in America, the news media has been among the least introspective. They've been among the least willing to look in the mirror and go, you know what, maybe we are showing contempt and disdain for our listeners and our readers, and maybe that's not a great business model. Maybe, in fact, these complaints of bias are not just obnoxious, some of them are, but maybe there's something to all of that. And the point that I make to the group is that, look, point number one is to recognize that this decline in trust has been happening for a very, very long time, and it's based on the fact that bias is real. And by bias, I mean that it is so pervasive that many journalists, I think, are like fish. They don't know that fish don't know that they're wet because they're just surrounded by water. And so many journalists just live in a world where everybody thinks like them. Everybody has the same priorities. Everybody has the same attitude towards conservative Christians or the pro-life movement. And look, and there's no question about it that the president has demagogued this issue, and there's something really deeply disturbing about his attacks against the enemy of the people. But there's also the reality that the media needs to come to grips with it. This has been a long time coming. There was a presentation at this event that talks about how trust in the American media has dropped in half. And this goes back into the 70s. So you go back to 1977. Remember 1977? 72% of Americans had at least a fair amount of trust in the media back then. That number has dropped down to 32% in 2016. I'm guessing that that's going to be even worse. So half of the decline occurs before the internet even came around, when you think about it. So, I mean, like, what happened? You had, the technology, you had cable television, created the choice. You didn't have the three networks. You had the rise of conservative talk radio, of which I was certainly part for many years. And we did market ourselves as the antidote to biased liberal media, and that became part of the political narrative. And in part, we were able to do that as a conservative talk show host because the rest of the media, and particularly in Wisconsin, essentially said, we're going to cede that territory to you. We're going to ignore conservatives. We're going to go out of our way to display our disdain or our contempt. So I remember thinking throughout the 1990s, this is kind of a gift that we're getting from the mainstream news media here in Wisconsin, that if they're not going to talk about issues that conservatives care about, that they're basically saying, here, you take this market, and this market may be half of the consumers of the news media. I don't know if I've ever actually mentioned that the editor-in-chief of the local newspaper in my hometown in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, actually blocks me on Twitter. No bias there. So this partisan split is pretty dramatic, and I think it's not going to come as a shock when I say that only 14% of Republicans trust in the media, 30% of independents say they trust in the media, 51% of Democrats say they trust in the media. There's historical reasons for that. It's interesting that the number for Democrats is only at 51. But you want to talk about an ominous sign, this generational shift. If you ask people 18 to 49 if they trust the media, to be fair, only 26% say they do. So 26% of 18 to 49-year-olds still trust the media. 38% of 50 or over still trust the media. So it's bad, but it's getting worse, and it's heading in the wrong direction. And keep in mind that most of this change took place before 2016. you know, Donald Trump has come in and he's made the term, you know, fake news, you know, part of our political glossary. The media are the enemy of the people. The, you know, he talks about the failing media. And of course, as I've said before, no, the goal of this is to delegitimize much of the news media. And look, a lot of that criticism is valid. The problem is if you succeed in, frankly, delegitimizing all fact-based media, that you eliminate all of the guardrails, all of the independent arbiters of truth, to the point where we're at right now, and I think we're right at the precipice, of people just, you know, wondering, who do I believe? What do I believe? News media may come up with, you know, fantastically well-reported journalism, but we have about half of Americans who aren't going to believe anything, even if it in fact is truth. And so we're in this era now where people disbelieve facts. There are people who, you know, frankly, will just decide that, well, I'm going to believe what I want to believe. And then this is the way that, you know, this is the way human beings are wired. We would all like to think, right, that people use their minds to determine what is true, what is factual. Actually, people use their minds to strengthen their bonds to their tribe. And if something confirms their bias, they will grab onto it. If they are confronted with an inconvenient fact, it doesn't take much data for them to reject it. And so now we're in an era where there are no trusted third parties for the media. So one of the questions at the, you know, at this conference I was at was, you know, how are people in journalism going to respond to this existential challenge? I mean, how do you report facts about someone who believes that facts are subordinate to beliefs, or how do you report facts in a world in which people, in fact, are not necessarily going to change their minds based on what's out there? And how does a media that has squandered its credibility get it back? And that's one of the points that I think that that I tried to make, which is that, you know, the asset of any news media organization, your number one asset is credibility. And once you have squandered that credibility, it is intensely difficult to get it back. And it is also, we no longer live in an era in which you have a monopoly of attention. In an attention economy, it doesn't take much effort on the part of consumers, readers, voters, citizens to simply swipe left and move on. If you violated their sense of fairness, if you violated their sense of trust, they don't need to read you anymore. They don't need to get their news from the daily newspaper or from ABC or CBS. And so the proliferation of new news media outlets, which is going to accelerate. I mean, we're on one right now. This does pose an existential threat to the business model. And I have to tell you that I'm not sure that a lot of folks in the mainstream media have really come to grips with some of this underlying problem of bias and credibility. And in part, it's because they all share the same assumptions. Right now, it's particularly difficult because one of the things they share is antipathy for President Trump. And I don't think they're necessarily wrong in some of their attitudes towards that. But this antipathy also plays out when you're talking about a lot of the social and cultural issues. And we did a podcast with Arthur Brooks from AEI a few weeks ago. And he pointed out that if someone feels that you have contempt for them or despise them, they are not going to be persuadable. They're not going to listen to you. And I think this is a problem for the media that needs to come to grips with the reality that smugness is not an effective business strategy. And to the extent that they in fact do share a set of assumptions that hold large parts of the electorate and leaving aside Trump, because Trump's going to be gone. You know, Trump wasn't always here, and Trump's going to be gone. But if this contempt survives Trump and Trumpism, and it is a disconnect with huge parts of the country, guess what? Those constituencies will tune out the mainstream media, and once they've tuned them out, it's going to be very hard to get them back, particularly when there are more than enough folks out there who are going to greet them with open arms and say, you don't want to read that? You can read this. So in any case, was anything resolved at the conference I was at? I don't think so. But it's and I would like to say that we're engaging in a great sort of navel gazing. But I think that the media is focused right now on, oh my God, we're being destroyed. Even as, and by the way, when I say destroyed, I mean outside of the New York Times and the Washington Post. Well, they're doing fine, but much of the rest of the media is experiencing almost a free fall. When you look at what's happening at newspapers around the country, the huge areas of the country that have become news deserts, or which are served by ghost newsrooms, big newspapers that used to have hundreds of reporters that are now down basically shells. And so this shock is working through American journalism, but it hasn't gotten to the point with going like, wow, maybe we shouldn't have had those, ignored our critics so assiduously over all of those years. Maybe we shouldn't have blocked them all on Twitter. In any case, this is going to be a conversation we're going to have for some time. And the focus of today's podcast is my conversation with Howard Schultz. Howard Schultz, who is considering running for president of the United States, is exploring that possibility. And he joins me right here on the Bulwark Podcast. Now, do you describe yourself as the emeritus CEO of Starbucks? Would that be the title you would like to go by, Mr. Schultz?
Chairman Emeritus.
Chairman Emeritus. And, of course, Mr. Schultz is in a tour of the heartland considering whether or not to mount an independent presidential run. You just finished up in Kansas, and you are in St. Louis today, I understand.
That is correct. I've been on a bus tour in Kansas, had an extraordinary few days, and I'm in St. Louis speaking to a large group of young professional business people in about 45 minutes.
Okay. Now, I was looking up material about your campaign, and I see all the things that you are doing and the issues that you're taking, but I'm also noticing that you have, it's like you've taken a stick into the beehive of the Democrats, who feel apparently have a sense of real entitlement to all of the votes, people who won't vote for Donald Trump. And it's sort of reflected in some of the media coverage. Have you been at all discouraged by the blowback you've gotten, or surprised by the intensity of the blowback, particularly from Democrats to your candidacy?
I am not discouraged in the least. I'm not deterred. I expected there would be resistance from the Democratic Party, but I must say, I think the narrative that the DNC and the Democratic Party has kind of gotten out there is a false narrative. I strongly believe that we are going to pick off lifelong Republicans, if I choose to run, who are dissatisfied with the character and morality of this president, and if they have a choice between me, Donald Trump, and a left-leaning person who is espousing socialistic views, I think it's going to be many more Republicans than Democrats, although I think moderate Democrats are never going to choose a socialist for their president.
So let's talk about that. You obviously had to think about why you did not want to run as a Democrat, what it is about the Democratic Party that you don't feel at home. So talk to me about that a little bit. Why you are not running in the Democratic primary, because there seems to be lots of room, a lot of people in there, a lot of, water's warm.
It's not so much running against the Democratic Party as it is running against the system that has become so corrupt and so polarized and so dysfunctional. I think both parties are complicit with their lack of truthfulness, honesty, lack of leadership. And, we could talk about the $22 trillion debt, the immigration issue, the healthcare crisis. Mm-hmm. All of these things are linked not only to the Democratic Party, but both parties' inability to compromise and get things done for the American people. What I have been critical of is the far left leaning position that the Democratic Party has gone to. I mean, in 2015, Bernie Sanders, his ideas were seemed to be not only unrealistic, but fringe and kind of fantasy. And today, as we sit, it really does appear that his positions are now the proxy for the Democratic platform that the Democrats all are going to run on. And every one of them are running left of each other, embracing things like the Green New Deal, which these are well-intentioned people, but it's unrealistic. There's a better way forward, and certainly we can't afford it. And so it's quite surprising to me. But let me say this. The Republicans for 8 years during President Obama's tenure as president were banging on him every single day regarding the debt and the deficit. Republicans at one time, in my mind, stood for fiscal responsibility and discipline. In 2 years, Trump has added $2 trillion to the national debt. And to my knowledge, we have not heard one word, not one word from any Republican congressman or senator talking about the debt because it's not in their political interest. And this is what is wrong with our system. Both parties are engaged in a level of ideology and self-interest, and that is why I have decided to consider running for president as a centrist independent.
Well, I agree with you on the national debt, and I've talked about this. Is one of the most disconcerting things watching the party that, in fact, I'm from Wisconsin, you know, talked to Paul Ryan about this hundreds of times, and then suddenly it's like, well, never mind. Is it because, let's talk about the Republicans' abandonment of fiscal conservatism. Is it because they were never serious or because they realized that, quite frankly, the voters don't seem to care about this, that there really is no constituency for fiscal conservatism?
Listen, I've been traveling the country now for 11 weeks. I've been in a different city and or state almost every day talking to American people, as I did yesterday in Kansas. Make no mistake, the American people are well aware and deeply concerned about the national debt and what this means for their kids and grandkids. I think it's just political convenience that this president and this party has completely gone away from what Ronald Reagan stood for since the mid-80s. It's shocking to me that the party that stood for fiscal conservatives and such a level of financial discipline and a fiduciary responsibility to the American people have completely abdicated their responsibility. It's just politics to them.
Obviously, both parties have priorities. The Republicans have a priority to cut the taxes. The Democrats have the priority to expand government spending programs. You have criticized the Trump tax cuts. Would you repeal the Trump tax cuts? And what other practical, tangible steps would you take that you think would be politically possible to narrow the deficit?
Well, I think there's two things we're trying to solve for. The first thing is that the President of the United States has a responsibility in terms of the executive budget that he's submitting to Congress to spend less than we're taking in. That has not been the case, and the budget that the president presented over the last few weeks, we all know, is dead on arrival. That's irresponsible and a lack of leadership. But what are we trying to solve for? We're trying to solve for increased economic growth, and obviously we've got to spend less than we're taking in. So in terms of your core question about the tax cut, I think the corporate tax cut should have been closer to 25 or 26%. Corporate America did not need a tax rate of 21%. We would be competitive on the world stage at 25 or 26, and I would incent corporations throughout the country to get a lower tax rate based on doing things that are critically important to our society and to bridge the gap of inequality, specifically paying for college for their employees, and comprehensive health insurance, retraining, giving back to the communities we serve, but businesses and business leaders are going to have to do more. But then the issue and the third rail of politics that no Democrat and no Republican will touch or talk about because it's not politically in their interest is that somebody has to have a important conversation about entitlements. And what I would do is, if I was fortunate to be president, is start speaking about a means test on entitlements where the wealthy would not only be paying higher taxes and getting less, but not qualify for Social Security, they don't need it. And for the first time, someone needs to talk about feathering in, since the American people are living longer, that's a good thing, feathering in over a longer period of time, the beginning of a discussion about raising the age. And so, and that's big money. What we're talking about here is leadership, the truthfulness, and the honesty necessary. The other thing I'd say about the national debt and why I think people are concerned about it, not only in terms of the immorality of our kids and grandkids, but this is about our national security. We are not going to have the resources that are required to invest in the future of our domestic policy and to do everything we need to do to secure our safety. If we keep piling up debt. And by the time President Trump leaves office, hopefully in 2020, it's going to be closer to $25 trillion.
Let's double back on this, but you mentioned before, you know, the Democrats are moving in exactly the opposite direction, and just in the last couple of days, Bernie Sanders unveiled his Medicare for All plan, and this appears to be, as you mentioned also, this appears to be gathering a lot of support on among Democrats. So what is your critique of the Medicare for All?
It's very simple. First of all, the Republicans, for 9 years, want to eradicate the Affordable Care Act with no solution. So they're wrong. The Democrats under Bernie Sanders want Medicare for all, free for everybody. Why is that wrong? For a couple of reasons. One, 180 million Americans get their insurance by their employer. The disruptive nature of going from that to Medicare for all, government takeover of our health insurance, that would be incredibly disruptive, and I have no faith and confidence the government can do it. Secondarily, The issue of the government trying to manage this process and in doing so eradicate the insurance industry would eliminate millions of jobs of people who are employed in the insurance industry as well as in the adjacent employees supporting that. It is unrealistic, and Bernie Sanders has been running on this issue for 4 years. Without ever demonstrating to anyone how it could be paid for. And with $22 trillion of debt and $33 trillion on top of it in terms of this, there's just no way. The better way, the answer to the question is, what are we trying to do? Provide more access to the uninsured and lower the cost curve. So I think the best way to do that is to develop universal catastrophic coverage, including pre-existing conditions, that would begin to lower the cost curve, coupled with more transparency, more competition, interstate commerce among insurance industry. And then the last piece of this, and perhaps the most perverse, is the fact that the government is not negotiating with pharma on prescription drug prices. And so We could lower the Affordable Care Act was not perfect. We have a problem with it now because the premiums are 2x as to what it was 9 years ago. We can attack that, and we can provide access to people. These problems that we have are self-induced. We can fix it, but we can't fix it if the members of Congress are taking lobbying self-interest money from pharma, and as a result of that, they will not negotiate drug prices. And this is all part of the contempt that I have for the system and the fact that the system is now corrupt.
Okay, let's talk about what in fact is possible, because it's certainly very, very plausible that the two-party system has become completely dysfunctional and has become, you know, completely unresponsive. So let's assume for the moment that you have become president of the United States. You are neither a Democrat nor a Republican, but virtually everybody else in Congress is a member of the red team or the blue team, and we know how tribal our politics has become. What makes you think that having destroyed their hopes, beaten their candidates in this election, that they are somehow going to sit down with you and work out these bipartisan, tripartisan solutions? How does that actually work in the real world?
Well, I think it's a fair and legitimate question. I will answer that, but I have to ask you a question. Is there any evidence whatsoever that if a Democrat wins the White House or President Trump gets reelected, that we're going to see any change that is positive for the American people in 2020?
No, absolutely not. That's okay. An easy one.
All right, so I'm glad we got that under where we got common language. So can you imagine, given how exhausted, fed up, and disgusted the American people are with this level of dysfunction, polarization that's going on, that they send an independent person to the White House for the first time since George Washington, the power of that historic moment, and in doing so, send this message to Republicans and Democrats that we want our government back, that we are the people, you are going to serve us. Now, here's the other issue. Unlike a Democrat in the White House or President Trump getting reelected, I don't go into the Oval Office if I'm fortunate enough to win as an enemy of either party. In fact, what I'm going to be seeing for the next 18 months is there are good people on both sides, good ideas. I agree with the Republicans on many things. I agree with the Democrats on many things. Let's work together. I've publicly said I would have the most bipartisan cabinet in the history of the United States government and bring sanity, civility, dignity, and honor back to the White House and a level of leadership that serves the American people. And I think the American people will fire those Democrats and Republicans who don't play along. And I think you'll see hundreds of new people running for office at state and federal positions under the independent flag, because the President of the United States will have given license for an independent voice.
Okay, so but obviously the elephant in the room here, and I think it explains a lot of the reaction that you're getting to your candidacy, is this question of whether or not you would be a spoiler, that if you get in this race, that you would take votes away from the Democrats, and that there is no way for you to get to 270. So that the only effect that you would have in this race is to reelect Donald Trump. That appears to be the conventional wisdom on the left. So as you consider whether or not to make your candidacy formal, how do you think through that question of, will I be the factor that allows a president with a 43% approval rating to be reelected? And is there any reasonable way of a path for you to get 270 electoral votes?
There is absolutely a path to 270. And let me explain the theory of the case to you and your listeners. Whenever you're trying to do something against a grain that hasn't been done before, there's going to be a lot of people tell you that it can't be done. I understand that. And my responsibility is to demonstrate credibility and legitimacy in this process. No one wants to see Donald Trump removed from office more than me. And I certainly don't want to be a spoiler. And I don't want to see a left-leaning socialist become the president of the United States. Having said that, here's the theory of the case. Over the last 30-plus years, basically, 8 to 10 battleground states have decided who is going to be the president of the United States. If I enter the race as a centrist independent for the first time in 30-plus years in over 40 states, everyone's vote will matter, Republican or Democrat. So if you live in Kansas, where it has been a Republican state since 1964, for the first time, your vote as a Democrat really matters. The same thing is true in Arizona. Same thing is true in California if you're a Republican. All I need is 15% to be on the debate stage. I will get to 15%, and then it's a three-person race. And this whole perception, which is ill-conceived and a false narrative, mainly being spread by the DNC, is not true with regard to me being a spoiler. The spoiler in this race, if there is going to be one, will be the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Beto O'Rourke, Gillibrand, all of these Democrats who are far left-leaning. And then the question I have, which I think is the most important question of all of these problems that we have right now, which I believe can be and should be solved and have not been solved by a lack of leadership and truthfulness, all these Democrats who are currently holding a federal position at the congressional or senatorial level, where have they been? What have they been doing? All of these promises they're making, where have they been the last 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, 10 years? They have contributed to the complicit nature of this dysfunction. And as a result of that, they do not deserve to be the president of the United States.
Okay, you listed a number of the leading Democratic candidates who you described as left-leaning socialists. What about a Mayor Pete Buttigieg? What about Joe Biden? Does that change your calculus in getting in and staying in the race? Amy Klobuchar,
No. At this point, the merit of my decision is going to be based on what I believe I can offer the American people, and I'm trying to be as thoughtful as possible about that. But I think it's very instructive to me that Mayor Bloomberg, someone I highly respect, decided there was no room for him as a centrist moderate in the Democratic Party today. And I think what the public is going to find out is whether Vice President runs or not, and I hope he does. There's going to be no room for him as well. Democratic Party has cast their die. They want their calculus, which I do not understand, is they believe the way to beat Donald Trump is with the extreme far, far left. I think it's going to be a terrible tragedy. They're going to reelect Donald Trump, and they're going to be the spoiler.
This also raises the question, though, that there may not be any room in the Democratic Party for a centrist, but what about the Republican Party? Did you think at all about, you know, why not run as a Republican? A lot of your critique of what's going on sounds very conservative, or at least would have an appeal to Republican primary voters. When you talk about the critique of Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, when you talk about fiscal responsibility, those seem like the kinds of things that Republican candidates have talked about for years. So why is Howard Schultz not running as the opposition candidate to Donald Trump in the Republican primaries?
Well, I think you're correct in saying that what I believe is very much of a centrist. And as a result of that, I embrace ideas from both parties. But it would be quite disingenuous of me to come to the conclusion that the real problem we have is the dysfunction and the revenge politics and the lack of honesty on both sides to run as a Republican. That never even crossed my mind.
Really?
We have to break, disrupt, and transform the system, which is filled with self-interest, self-preservation, and people have lost sight of why they are there. The character of the Congress and the Senate, I have deep questions about, because they have lost sight of their responsibilities.
You mentioned before Kansas, and I don't mean to keep coming back to the spoiler issue, but you mentioned that that voters in 40 states would have their votes count for the first time, including Democrats in the state of Kansas, which seems to suggest, though, that if you were in the race, that Democrats would have a chance to win Kansas. This is, of course, the kind of talk that makes Democrats' heads explode, right?
You know, we've done a lot of work in examining the historical voting records of all 50 states. For example, we believe if Donald Trump does not win the state of Texas, he can't get the 270. If I enter the race, three-person race, I have a very good chance of winning the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. So we think there's a path to 270. And the way that I'm looking at this is not through the lens of whether I'm going to take votes from the Democrat or Republicans. I'm looking at this at 42% of the American people today who have voted in the past affiliate themselves as an independent. And 70% no longer trust and have faith and confidence in our leaders in government. Just think about that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a time in America where if the Democrats go so far to the left and Donald Trump continues to behave the way he is, and there's certainly every evidence that he will, that the character morality issue of him is going to be in question. The far left liberal side on the Democrats will be in question. And, you know, in the Fox Town Hall last week on live television, I asked an audience on live television, I said, raise your hand. It was 400 people. If any of you in this audience want your child or your grandchild to behave and emulate the values and the character of this president, not one hand went up. And so the character issue, I think, is going to be a huge part of the narrative here, despite the strength of the economy, which is serving lots of people in America. But at the same time, 40% of the American families are $400 away from a crisis.
What is your timetable to make a formal decision here?
By early July, my wife and I and our kids will make a very thoughtful, disciplined decision. The next president of the United States needs to be the right person. This is much more about the American people than it is about me. And I just want to make sure we get the right person elected for president. And in my view, it cannot be Donald Trump.
Howard Schultz, thank you so much for talking with us today. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.